Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to our Thanksgiving episode, everyone.
Thanksgiving-uka, to be technical.
Do tell.
Well, it's the first overlap of Thanksgiving and Hanukkah in 125 years.
That explains those tweets I've been seeing. This is early for Hanukkah.
It's very early. And I just got a friend of mine just sent me a link to an article at SeriousEats.com for latke crusted turkey stuffing fritters with liquid cranberry core and turkey schmaltz gravy.
Sounds good to me.
in the share household, we celebrate Hanukkah and Christmas, and so we will be lighting a menorah at Thanksgiving. And I will try to work in my annual fried donuts. I don't know if I can pull it off this year, but I always try to do homemade potato flour buttermilk donuts, deep fried and then dipped in honey.
That sounds pretty good. You should put one of those in the mail for us in Southern DMZ.
And I do this even though, like, I wasn't even raised Jewish. I'm Jewish on my father's side. I was raised Catholic, but I never went to Hebrew school. I have no actual knowledge of Jewish culture and traditions, but I can convey the donuts. I feel I owe it to my children for that.
I think traditions are great. and the, you know, why not do both? It's terrific. I like
it's more gifts.
Yeah, because you got the 8 crazy nights, so that's really cool.
My wife dumped in the whole Advent calendar, so we have this whole Advent calendar where she puts little tchotchkes in, you know, for the entire month. So there's totally spoiled right at this point.
That is excellent. We've been watching Charlie Brown Christmas, Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, Charlie Brown Mayflower, and just opened Veggie Tales about Saint Nicholas. So we've been watching a lot of little children's stuff, and I like to I'm trying to downplay the whole Santa Claus thing and the commercialism,
right?
So, you know, that's a great thing. You know, the Charlie Brown Christmas special doesn't even mention Santa Claus. He's mentioned in the Great Pumpkin episode, but not in the Christmas special. And so I really like those messages. So, you know, I'm trying to find.
Do you have any evidence that's working? Are you magically raising non-materialistic children?
So far, so good. It's too early to tell. But the thing that they've never once come to me, and here's the problem that you have if you try to do this, is that well-intentioned adults will come up to your kids and say, "What's Santa bringing you?"
Right, right.
As if that's what the whole purpose is. I'm trying to sort of. Because I used to get depressed after Christmas that, you know, you open up all your presents and then it would be like a total letdown.
Right.
So I'm trying to, like, introduce a sort of vibe that Christmas, that the Christmas season lasts from about, you know, now until the Epiphany, and that there's no, like, big thing, you know, like Christmas morning when you open your presents, that it's all, like, you know, a season. And I think, Bill, what you're doing with the Hanukkah and with the stretching out the gifts and all that, helps to reinforce this idea that I'm pushing.
No, it does not. It does the exact opposite.
Oh, is it bad?
Oh, it's just, you know, you give one gift and then where's the next one? It's never ending. You never satisfy the quest for gifts, and then you have this big, you know, climactic moment of Christmas where you're just deluged with presents.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kid just gets, like, you know, super wired, and then it never satisfies. It's just where's the next one? Where's the next one? So it's a death spiral of materialism. I am a failure as a Christmas Hanukkah parent. So if you've managed to restrain the impulses of your children, my hats are off to you.
Well, I'm very happy. My wife deserved all the credit for this. She's very big into giving, so we just gave a bunch of toys away to some a friend of ours who works with, I guess, needy children or special needs children who don't have any stuff. So, like, we had that talk with Burke, who's not even 3 yet, about how, like, because he wanted to play with those toys, you know. And we had to talk with him about their kids that don't have any toys. So hopefully that will mean something to him. I'm getting a little choked up.
So he's
because I remember I'm getting a little choked up because he's not three. I remember my parents doing the same thing, and that's what Christmas ought to be about, Bill. You know, I've tried to say things like that. What's that?
I've tried to say things like that to my oldest daughter. I've tried to say, well, you know, Christmas is not really about the gifts; it's about spending time with the friends of who we love, and that's not sinking in yet.
Well, I suspect it's a process, and I'm sure, you know, so far, so good, knock on wood, on with my kids, but I don't think they're old enough yet to lust for the material goods to the degree that, like, maybe a five-year-old might, right?
Maybe.
I mean,
this year might be your D-Day. Good. Let's talk in January and see how this goes.
What I have to do is keep the in-laws. TV is a big problem, right? But luckily we're managing that by showing these videos. To the extent we watch TV, we're watching these videos that I've sort of pre-selected.
Right.
And the other problem is, like, the in-laws and family who want to spoil the kids and talk about the man in the red suit and all that. So, you know, those are the two big obstacles we face.
Well,
it's a two-front war. A two-front war to continue your analogy.
I made the mistake of showing the girls YouTube's videos on YouTube. You know, I can find children's shows, and I try to pre-select and do things that have you know, good meshing. And I've tried to sit with them because what I've read is that what's really problematic in videos is not so much things like violence. Which are easy to avoid if you try, at least if you have girls. It might be harder with boys. People acting mean is very difficult to avoid because it's in almost everything. There's always some kind of conflict.
Lucy pulling the football out. And
right.
Charlie Brown's a blockhead. Yeah.
And a young child is not going to follow the story arc and learn the message at the end of the show. They're just going to see the act of meanness and want to copy that.
Right.
So what I've tried to do, and I think this actually has worked, is, you know, when I'm sitting with her and I see it happening, I will point it out. And say that person's not acting nice. You know, that's not the proper way to treat other people. And do that repeatedly, so that message, so it's not just a one off. You know, it's been a consistent thing that I bring up whenever she's watching shows. And I have seen her in her actual life call attention to someone not acting nicely and responding in a proper way. So I think I actually pulled that one off. But it's relentless. I mean, you have to totally stay on top of it. And the problem with YouTube is a show will finish and then suggestions for other shows get shoved into your face and she'll see an image and want to do that show.
Yeah.
And she's adept enough on these devices that she'll, if I'm not paying close attention, she'll just pick it.
Right.
And now, I'm in a Barbie rabbit hole that I gotta, like, drag her out of.
They love technology. Even my, you know, Beckett, my little 1 year old, is from the minute he could desire something and crawl or try to get something, it will always be the iPhone or the remote control.
Right.
They have this, like, innate desire for this, and they very quickly learn how to do the thing with the iPhone where they, like, you know, swipe it. And of course, marketing, you know, if you, you know, you always want to have, whether it's a blog post or whatever, you know, other options for people to click. So it stands to reason that they would try to, like, seduce and entice clicking another video. But it does create challenges for parents. Our kids obviously are lucky, Bill, that they have both have two parents who are interested in them and trying to help them be good people and monitoring their media consumption and thinking about these things. Sadly, I mean, we're heroes. Let's be honest. American heroes. Chris Rock would probably beg to differ that we're just doing our job, but yeah.
Well, perhaps we should talk about our usual thing, the whole political thing.
I thought we'd just call it a day. Good show. Have fun. Redskins got killed last night. That's that. But if you want to inject politics into this discussion, the way that Obama wants us to talk about Obamacare over Thanksgiving dinner, then by all means.
So as I like to do, like to self promote, I have a piece up at the week, which poses the question on everybody's mind: is John Kerry a better Secretary of State than Hillary Clinton?
Wait, was that you?
That was me.
All right, this shows the beauty of marketing, because I saw that piece floating around on Twitter, and I did not even know that it was you. It was probably tweeted out by the week, and so that's. I always say, like, on political campaigns, 13 years ago, I was helping a woman run for school board. And the night before the election, we were calling voters, to likely voters to make sure they were going to turn out. And I got a hold of this old lady, and I was like, can I count on you to vote for Linda Naylor for school board? And she goes, my goodness, yes. I saw you kids waving signs at the mall today, and then someone left a flyer on my door this afternoon. I'm like, I knew that she won the election that minute. When we're calling a voter who had
three points of contact.
Yes, in one day, it's game over.
Right,
you've won, right. And that's what's happening with you now, Bill, with your columns. You're even trying to put them in front of me, and I'm seeing them. That's a win.
I appreciate that. Does this matter that Kerry got a peace deal that Hillary didn't get? Is this going to make her look weak in 2016 or anything like that? And I didn't even get into 2016 in the column because I concluded that actually was not what was relevant here. I don't think that Hillary's base of support and initial lead in polling is based upon concrete accomplishments at state. It's based on a lifetime of public service experience, of perseverance. The fact that she did a solid job at state, reaffirmed a lot of that. She didn't necessarily need to have like a giant mega accomplishment to as a calling card to earn from her status. She had it anyway. So I don't think it's actually a 2016 issue. I think it's an issue as far as what do we want out of a Secretary of State? What is the best kind of diplomat for American and global interests? And when you have somebody who is a presidential aspirant who is going to be inherently cautious to interject herself in a high-profile, intractable problem where if she falls short, understandably, she'll get tagged as being this giant failure. Or do you want someone who is a presidential also-ran, who this isn't a stepping stone, this is a capstone, and that guy wants is going to go all out. He's hungry for accomplishments. He's gonna push the boundaries. He's gonna insert himself everywhere he can, and get the best deal that he can. Obviously, there is a strain of skepticism on the right, although this comes from some Democrats too. It's not just from Republicans, but I think it's a conservative, cautious attitude towards diplomacy that if you're too hungry for a deal, you'll get a bad deal. And I suggest in the piece that even so-called bad deals don't necessarily have bad impact. They are even the worst deal you can think of, Munich, all the worst that it did was that it gave Britain an extra year to build up its military, which was flat on its back. And so perhaps it even helped them resist Hitler where they might have been steamrolled.
Maybe the worst it did for England, but, there were other countries involved.
But they may not have been, that may not have been stoppable. That may have been the best deal. There was a piece in Slate about this recently that I thought laid out the case very nicely. That may have been the best possible deal at that moment. The problem was that everyone disarmed so badly while Germany was building up. That was the problem. But once you're at that point in 1938, staving off the broader war might have been the more politically hard-headed thing to do, so you'd have time to build up your reserves and then take them on in 39 and beyond. At minimum, we didn't lose the war. You know, Munich didn't lose us the war. So that to me says it's worth taking the risk on these things. You know, with some, obviously you want to have a hard head about it, not just go willy-nilly, but you can't think of a lot of peace agreements that actually made you lose something at the end. Whereas there are hasty military actions that actually cause a lot of death and destruction. So, you know, the worst thing that happens out of this Iran deal, if it doesn't work out, then you're back where you were. You still have a military option at the end of the day. So I would
dispute everything you're saying, but I don't want to get into the debate because your larger point about the column isn't whether or not the Iran deal is a good deal or a bad deal, but it's about, you know, Kerry and Clinton. And I think that is a less contentious between us debate to have. And it could be that, so what is your conclusion though? Do you not want to give that away? I mean, is it just nuanced or?
I mean, my conclusion is, to be nuanced about it, I don't think Hillary was a bad Secretary of State. She had plenty of successes. You know, she had the Libyan resolution at the UN. She had the easing of sanctions on Burma, furthering political reforms. The way she integrated women's issues into American foreign policy generally is a shift. You know, so she has her and you give her Iran credit. You know, she spent her time on the sanctions, not on the diplomacy. But you could argue that set the stage for Rouhani's election, which created the opening for Kerry. So, I mean, I think she has her successes. The fact that Kerry has been more aggressive at getting the peace deals, and we'll see how successful he is in Israel-Palestine or with North Korea or with Syria. It's not a final determination whether the Iran deal is going to work out in the end. This is a temporary deal. So, all that in mind, you can't make a final judgment until, you know, the 4 years are done. I still think this tips the balance to say better to have an aggressive diplomat that tries to create opportunities, because opportunities don't often, I mean, the amount of work that went into this Iran deal, which is a small deal, was an enormous amount of work. It wasn't just going to happen organically. You had to work for it. So I think that is an argument for having a Secretary of State that doesn't have another political job in mind down the line, is going to go all in on this job and get the best deals that are possible. And I'm less concerned about erring on the side. I'm less concerned about having a bad deal, because most bad deals have mitigations down the line. They don't necessarily condemn you to a permanent loss. So I'd rather see someone push the envelope. That's my bottom line. Your bottom line is probably different.
Well, I mean, I would, you know, one point would be like, once Iran gets the bomb, there's no going back from that.
But if he did nothing, I mean, you could be on the verge of it anyway. The point.
Obviously the sanctions were hurting them bad enough to bring them to the negotiating table. You know, perhaps the sanctions seem to be having some real effect, which could have undermined the entire regime.
I think the sanctions were important. I'm not. Oh, so you're saying the sanctions could have undermined the regime? Well, I mean, there's less evidence of that. I mean, you could try to hold out for that, I suppose. But at the end of the day, the fear on all sides is they actually get the nuke, and nothing in this deal stops us from exercising a military option if we think they're getting too close. I mean, we're still monitoring what's going on. If it's 4 months in and they're cheating and they get close, we could say you broke the deal and you can go in. So this doesn't negate anything.
I don't think anybody thinks that Barack Obama is going to do that. Or, you know, I mean, well, that's, there's skepticism.
That's a judgment on who you think Obama is as a person. But he was pretty close to going in Syria. He did go in Libya. He did do the
well,
right
Syria was a Syria was a joke. The fact Syria just reinforces my point that you really get. I mean, they, you know, speaking of John Kerry, I mean, essentially compared Assad to Hitler, made it out to be this huge moral humanitarian crisis, and then somehow allowed Putin to, you know, keep an eye on the chemical weapons. If that's the model for how he's going to,
I don't think we see the whole inspection regime is handed over to Putin. It's a UN operation, and of course now and there's actually Syria peace talks that are in the offing right now. So I don't think we can finally judge the outcome of that until it's over. I understand your skepticism. I understand. I mean, you could be skeptical of Obama as a person in all of these matters. That's a matter of opinion, but I don't think there's anything about the deal itself. I mean, let's say this was Ronald Reagan, this was George W. Bush who did this deal. You could have the same exact deal with a conservative president who could then say, if you cheat, I'm going to blow you up. I mean, the deal itself does not prevent that. So not having the deal, it would mean that Iran would move apace. So yeah. I don't see the risk of the deal itself.
My sense is the sanctions were clearly working and should have probably doubled down on the sanctions and not.
Will you want a regime change from them? I mean,
everyone should want a regime. And what was the policy, you know, our policy going forward? I mean, this is really a reversal of, you know, UN policy.
I mean, let's say a regime change would be the proper goal of sanctions. I mean, I don't think that ever was Obama's goal with the sanctions. I mean, it never was stated that way. But let's say it's what it should have been. A peace deal could be wrong, and that doesn't achieve its goal, and the regime change strategy could be wrong and not achieve its goal. So either way, you might reach a point when you think Iran gets too close to a nuke, where you might say, okay, now I need to engage militarily. Either way, you still reserve that option, and Obama's reserving that option now.
All right, literally watching my timeline here while you talk, John Kerry versus Hillary Clinton, who's the better Secretary of State? Tweeted by the week. I'm going to hit retweet right now and spread that out because this is, I think you're saturating the market today. I think you picked a day when there's not a lot going on and this story is going to have a lot of reach. All right. So enough of us fighting about the fighting. What else are we going to chat about today,
Bill? Well, I thought what happened yesterday, I don't think it's a totally slow news day. I thought what happened yesterday in immigration was actually quite a big deal.
You mean when he got heckled or?
Well, you know, the heckling I think is a little secondary. And I think the heckling is relevant in that it put the issue a bit more above the fold. And my general attitude is, I know you are very, I know you're chafing at some of the pressure tactics that are being used on Republicans right now, that you think they're kind of unseemly and alienating to conservatives.
Yeah, counterproductive.
Right.
We haven't talked about that. Well, you know this from Twitter, right? You and I don't think we've talked about that. Okay.
I know you were displeased when the two teenagers confronted Boehner at his breakfast spot on camera to try to pressure him into passing reform now, saying this is gonna make it harder for Republicans.
They've also showed up at his house and
right.
different people's houses and held like vigils outside their house, stuff like that. I mean, I can tell you that that makes me less likely to be supportive of them. And I'm the kind of person they should want on their side. So I think it's counterproductive.
And in your defense, I think there is evidence that those types of tactics by themselves are not magical. I think there is a notion on the left that confrontation always works in this respect. And, you know, we just went through a whole week of, you know, JFK remembrance. And, you know, there was one piece, I think it was at Slate, that and said I have touched upon in the past myself. I think I mentioned it in the in my New York Times piece, How Liberals Win, I'm trying to remember if it stayed in the piece or if it got cut, but I think it stayed in. You know, JFK tried to get Medicare passed by having big rallies targeting resistant conservative Democrats, and it just alienated them, and the bill did not get passed. Yeah. And it wasn't until there was a big shift in the membership of Congress after the 1964 elections when it got passed. So I take your point
thank you. But one point that I do want to make is some of the conservatives who are against immigration reform, when they think of Hispanics, they think of crime and lawlessness and the assumption that they will be legalizing a bunch of leftists who will be voting. That's what they fear. And when I think of Hispanics, I think of hardworking people, of close-knit families, of people who are entrepreneurial and, in many cases, better Americans than a lot of homegrown Americans. I mean, in terms of values and free enterprise and social values, families. But what these protests do nothing to reinforce what I think of. This reinforces the negative stereotype, the fear. It's starting to make me wonder, in fact. It's starting to make me wonder. Maybe Republicans, I was under the assumption, but maybe Republicans won't be able to win elections ever again if they do this. Because is that what this is? Or is a whole bunch of radical activist leftists that want to be legalized, and that's not something I'm interested in doing or helping.
Well, so taking all those possible risks into account, which I agree that there's always risks with confrontational tactics. In this case, what is the alternative? I think there is legitimate concern that if they were not employing these tactics, Boehner, being a politician who is not the most aggressive, creative, courageous type, if there's no pressure there, he's going to have all the reason in the world to bury the issue and not force his members to take a vote, which is inherently difficult for Republicans to take. So it's not illogical for the pro-immigration side to say, look, all we have at this point is the possibility of putting pressure on Boehner to say, if you don't do this, this gets worse. You look worse, your political prospects are worse. If I can't show you there's going to be consequences for your inaction, then you're not going to act. So I think in this case, there is a reasonable calculation to make that confrontation gives you more than it takes away.
Here's the problem, though, because people like me are, hopefully, I mean, how do I put this? This will probably sound bad or politically incorrect, but essentially, part of the reason that I supported immigration reform was certainly because you do have 11 million people here. What are you going to do with them? And again, I mean, I think that it's unrealistic that you would deport them. I wrote a piece a while back that had, five reasons why conservatives ought to support immigration reform. And, one of them was simply that, coming here is the most entrepreneurial thing you can do, or risk capital to come to this country to pursue the American dream. I mean, part of it is that I just think and I think it's good for America to have diversity. But the other part is, honestly, there's a sense that I want to be compassionate. And I think that when you look at evangelicals and evangelical conservatives who are, supportive of immigration reform or open to it, there are a lot of reasons for that. Now, the business interests, like the Wall Street sort of folks, they have maybe financial reasons to support, immigration reform. But I think a lot of the evangelical argument is that they're trying to be compassionate. They want to help people. This also undermines that. Because, wait a second, I was trying, I thought these were people who wanted to come and have a better life. And I'm trying to be understanding of that and open to that. And now they're going to go after, you know, my guys and harass them. That doesn't fly. So I think it's counterproductive. I think this is, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I think this is a strategic mistake that will harm their cause, not help their cause. I don't think you can pressure John Boehner into doing something like this.
Well, now, to go back to yesterday's event with Obama in San Francisco, he's getting this, too. He got heckled by an invited guest sitting behind the podium who had me on a document. I don't know where the invite came from, but apparently he had to get some kind of clearance to be there. And that person was trying to pressure Obama and say, you don't need Congress. You should be acting by executive order to stop deportations. And Obama said, no, I don't have that authority to do that. What I did with the Dreamers last year, that can't be made, overly broad to encompass everybody. And the lawyers can debate whether
it's true or not. But in fairness, as I recall, he had previously said that he couldn't do the Dreamer thing unilaterally.
He may have said that.
Maybe the lobbying of him actually... I mean, I think pressuring Obama is more likely to succeed because as president, he's more conscious of his legacy. And this is coming from his base.
Well, but that pressure on Obama was happening before an election last time. He's not on the ballot anymore. He wants to have a legacy that's locked in, not one that gets erased as soon as he walks out the door. Regardless of the
legal question. I would just say I think he may be more susceptible to that sort of lobbying on this particular issue than Boehner. I could be wrong.
Well, I think my original point on all this is I think, even though I think the heckling of Obama is misdirected, I think it belongs on Boehner because Boehner's the obstacle here and not Obama. I think the fact that a heckle occurred keeps this issue alive, and keeping it alive, keeping it above the fold, is part of the pressure that needs to be applied. If it seems like nobody's talking about it, then there's no reason for Boehner to act. So I think the heckle was a good thing, but I don't think it was the most important thing about yesterday. This part of Obama's speech was the most important. He said, I'm reading this now. The good news is, just this past week, Speaker Boehner said that he is, quote, hopeful we can make progress, unquote, on immigration reform, and that is good news. I believe the speaker is sincere. I think he genuinely wants to get it done, and that is something we should be thankful for this week. I think there are a number of other House Republicans who also want to get this done. Some of them are hesitant to do it in one big bill, like the Senate did. That's okay. It's Thanksgiving. We can carve that burden into multiple pieces. A drumstick here, breast meat there. As long as all the pieces get done soon, and we can actually deliver on the core values we've been talking about for so long, I think everybody is fine with it. They're not worried about the procedures. They just want the result. So I think in all of that, you have, one, Obama playing good cop to some of the activists, bad cop, saying, I'm not here to beat Boehner upside the head. I'm not trying to make this into a 2014 election issue. I am giving you preemptive political cover to say, you guys actually want to do this. You're not the bad guys here. We just have a procedural disagreement to do it comprehensively or in pieces. And I will concede to you, I'm fine doing it in pieces so long as we do all the pieces. And even threw in this soon to suggest they didn't all have to be done on the same day. And the big question there is, how is the citizenship piece handled? Will they accept pieces before the citizenship piece gets passed? That, I imagine, is a bit of an unknown question. But this is, I think, a pretty significant move towards Boehner's way and how to handle this in a way that Boehner feels most comfortable. Which I would think is pretty relevant as far as whether this does get done or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that let's see if the rhetoric, the sort of positive, rhetoric continues. But if they actually want to get something done, then this is the way to do it. And I mean, look, I've always thought that it would be in Republicans' best interest, not that you're twisting their arm to get them to do immigration reform. They ought to want to do it, for their own best interest, because it's good policy, because it's the right thing to do, and because they have to do it for political survival. And so I think that actually if Obama is sincerely trying to get this accomplished, the way to do it is to do exactly what he said in that speech. So whereas I think that the hardball tactics are counterproductive, I think that, you know, the killing them with kindness angle is probably much more likely to work. And it may not happen. It's certainly not going to happen this year, but going forward, I think it's a much more, you know.
You know, there's been a lot of talk, like, you know, everyone says it's not going to happen this year, as if December 31st is some sort of drop dead date. Yeah. It's not. I mean, there might be an amorphous drop dead date in the spring or summer before, you know, the campaign season ramps up. But, you know, until the congressional session is ended, the game's not over. So to me, the bigger deadline is around the spring, when the primary filing deadlines tend to expire. They vary state by state, but a lot of them are March, April, May. You know, once a Republican doesn't have to worry about a primary challenger, that's going to free up a lot of votes, I would think.
From the Republican standpoint, in terms of a timeline, this doesn't really, I don't think this affects the midterms at all. It doesn't, it certainly, doing immigration reform doesn't really help Republicans going into a midterm, but it may be something in terms of a general, you know, a presidential election that certainly could impact it. So there's that. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
And I think to your point, yeah, Republicans need to have a reason to do this that is a positive reason, and not seeming like they're just buckling to pressure to save their political hides. That's not going to be, that's not something you can then sell to your own people, let alone to the general populace. That just might make you look weak. There has to be a sense that they're doing it for their own set of principles and their own values. And so that's why I would agree with you that if all that was happening here was pressure tactics, that would probably not be enough to get this done. But if there's a mix of Obama saying these guys have the right idea and our differences are not ones of principle,
right,
I think that's going to give Republicans the cover that they need.
Again, and I would just reiterate something I've said already here, which is that these hardball pressure tactics only reinforce the fears that conservatives have about immigration reform. So they're, I would argue, they're very counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had, I thought, a courageous piece this week about Obamacare, where you try to give some tough love, I think, to conservatives, thinking it's going to be easy to exploit the troubles with the rollout. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Talk a little bit about it. It's not called 9 Things Conservatives Need to Know About Obamacare Going Forward. And I mean, honestly, I think there's something in here for everybody, for conservatives to like. And I think a bunch of interesting points. You know, so for example, number one, healthcare has always been a Democratic issue because they had the great sob stories. But for the first time, we're beginning to see sob stories about people who've been screwed by government. Some people, you know, think that when I say sob stories, that I'm dismissive. I mean, these are possibly quite often legitimate sob stories. I mean, they're really just heartbreaking stories. But my point is that up until now, this is the first time that that the conservative position has had emotion on their side. If you were going to, you know, the issue skewed Democratic until now. So that's number one, and I think that's probably a point that conservatives will like and agree with. Where I get into heroic territory, Bill, is when I start talking about Republican alternatives. And, you know, this is my opinion. Some conservatives may disagree. But, you know, one of the things I say is the big challenge any conservative alternative will face is, what do you do with pre-existing conditions? The only viable option seems to be to provide a one-time amnesty with very short enrollment periods so people don't think they can sign up after they're sick. And this, of course, will be messy. I also go on to talk, aside from the pre-existing conditions, I also, you know, bring up something which almost all the serious conservative alternatives talk about: tax credits. What they don't usually spell out, because it's uncomfortable for conservatives, is the notion that these must be refundable. Meaning that if you see, here's the deal. A conservative alternative to Obamacare, if it is to be serious and sellable, rather than mandating coverage, it would instead have to incentivize coverage. So essentially, you would have to make it in everyone's best interest to get health care without forcing them to. So in other words, you're using a carrot instead of a stick. Well, tax credits only work as an incentive if everyone is eligible. And as you know, a lot of people don't make enough money to pay taxes. So you would essentially have to have a refundable tax credit where people would literally be paid money, Bill, and in order to sign up for healthcare. That sounds sacrilegious.
Not all dissimilar to what's happening now. I mean, the people are getting subsidies now for healthcare under Obama.
Right, and I mean, I think you'd have a lot of conservatives saying, yes, it's not different than what it is now, and that's why it's horrible. I mean, this sounds sacrilegious, but my argument, Bill, would be that you cannot, it's just not politically feasible to go to a pure free market healthcare system, if such a thing even existed or were possible to exist. And so what you need to do is to find a much more conservative, much more free market way to incentivize coverage to help as many people as possible. And that gets messy, and that is where it was easy to poke holes in Obamacare. It's easy to talk about all the problems. Once you actually try to craft a workable alternative that would actually be, would have a chance of being popular enough to succeed, and wouldn't be vulnerable to all sorts of accusations. Well, we're going to go back to the case where if you're sick, you're on your own. To craft that alternative, it becomes very messy, and there are a lot of sort of things that conservatives are going to have to wrestle with. They might as well do it now, while they can sort of do it before they have to do it publicly.
I think this is absolutely fascinating. Both what you wrote, you also talked about what Stephen Hayes recently mentioned.
Yes.
I think it was on Fox that this might have a silver lining for conservatives because once Obamacare collapses, since we have these exchanges, people are going to be more inclined to be active consumers and divorce healthcare from their jobs, and that's what conservatives want. And it's sort of a tacit acknowledgement that these exchanges do exist in Obamacare, and that there's some of this buying behavior that's already happening. Both of your takes are, I think, an increasing acceptance that there's no turning back, that you can't go just back to repeal. And you're in a post Obamacare political environment as it comes to healthcare. Conservatives have to shift their thinking because of that. You don't just accept it a whole hog, but you have to recalibrate what your reform positions are.
I think that's true. And then it could be that in itself, is a legacy, and that now, I wouldn't be in favor of fixing Obamacare, but I would be for repeal and replace. And I think that, honestly, you have to really give this a lot of thought. And I think that there are some things like pre-existing conditions. Now, let me just say, I think that the pre-existing condition thing was overblown in the sense that if you work for a company and then you get sick, you could leave your job. If you get hired by another company, then you would have still, like last year, if you had a family member who was sick and you got a job, you got hired by a company, they would take you because you're an employee and you would go on their insurance if they offered insurance, and that would be part of the pool. The problem was, of course, for people in the individual market. And it's a real problem. I'm not trying to like dismiss it, but I am saying that I think that people don't understand that it maybe wasn't as quite as prevalent or pervasive as it's been made out to be. But I do think it's a problem that needs to be fixed and needs to be resolved. And I don't think you can, I just don't think it's good policy to have, as a compassionate society, to have a situation where, people can't get health coverage if they want it. You also don't want to incentivize a situation where people can game the system. And so that's why you have the enrollment periods and all that.
But then, I mean, I don't know if this is a shift for you personally. I think there is a potential shift in conservatism generally where, you know, a lot of the talk before Obamacare was, it's just not the government's business. You know, there's the market and insurers are going to do what they're going to do and they're going to set prices they want to set and give coverage they want to cover. And that's the way the market should work. And that's that. You know, the predominance of ideas coming from the right, not going all the way back to the Heritage Foundation's initial conception of the individual mandate, but after that, it was not about expanding coverage. It was not about covering pre-existing conditions. It was just about buying on the market and tax credits ran, and that was it. And now, you know, there was some consternation on the left that this isn't a public option. It's not single payer. It's just individual mandate that's just giving a big chunk of consumers to private insurance companies. But by doing that, what Obama has successfully done is say there's a baseline here that everyone should have coverage. Even if it's through private insurance, the government is tacitly making a commitment that everyone essentially will have coverage, you know, few exceptions out there. And things like pre-existing conditions are gonna get covered. And it becomes much, much harder now if you're an Obamacare critic to just take that away.
Right.
You have to come up with some other idea that's going to meet those goals at that point, and that's going to constrain your options.
Well, and there are things, I mean, this is the conservative fear about entitlements that they're hard to unwind. And I mean, there are things that are very popular, like the thing if you're under the age of 26, you can be on your parents' health care. That's really popular and would be very difficult to take back, even though Obamacare right now is wildly unpopular. So let me say, I do want to say these nine things, the assumption is that we're living in the real world. Now, you could certainly argue philosophically that the government shouldn't be involved in healthcare, and maybe that's true. But my point was to say, okay, we live in the real world, and if conservatives craft a better alternative that's more conservative and better for Americans, better for consumers, they have a chance to wrest this issue away from the Democrats who've owned it for a long time. I mean, that's what I started off with about how they had all the good sob stories. And this is maybe a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Republicans to steal the healthcare issue from Democrats if they take it seriously. And that would entail proposing something that is actually viable and would be popular. And I think that what I've laid out is an actual way to have a vastly more conservative alternative that's actually would be popular and could actually be implemented. You could argue philosophically that it's not good enough, it's not conservative enough, it's not free market enough, and that may be true, but I don't think a laissez-faire policy will sell. And so I think that if conservatives presented it, they would very quickly fail to capitalize on the Obamacare debacle should it collapse completely.
We'll see if your comrades on the right listen to you, as they usually should.
Well, they should. read it. Nine things conservatives need to know about Obamacare going forward. It's at the Daily Caller. And I think heroic is a good word. I'm, you know, not as a columnist and as a father, I think the word applies. So,
well, always good to talk to you, Matt. Enjoy your Thanksgiving, Yuka.
Certainly will.
And your Christmas season.
This is the year where Adam Sandler's Thanksgiving song and Hanukkah song finally converge. So, kudos.
I think it was at the week there was a sad piece which was explaining to the youngins all of the obscure 1990s references in the Thanksgiving song.
Yeah,
and that
Hall of Famer Rod Carew. Nobody, I'm sure nobody knows who he is anymore. He was actually Jewish. He converted.
Right.
And a really good hitter. I remember him playing for the California Angels when I was coming up. Great singles hitter. All right, Bill Scher, happy Thanksgiving to you and to all of you in DMZ land. Until next time.
Take care.